Good afternoon, your honors. My name is Joseph Huff. I represent Gregory Trammell. My registration number is 34384. I'm going to try to get to both issues today, but I'd like to spend the bulk of my time on the first issue. And I think everybody's in agreement here that the first issue boils down to two separate parts. Number one, did the clergy communicate privilege apply in this case? And if it did, was it harmless or not? The admission of the statements to the clergyman. Now, I think the best way to approach this is to compare and contrast the last case that this or any other Colorado court has dealt with dealing with the clergy communicant privilege, and that's the People v. Police case. It's out of this court from 1982. That court found that in that case, under those particular facts, there was no clergy communicant privilege. And they base their ruling primarily on four different things. So I want to go over those. And I'm going to quote the case in particular. It says, the defendant in that case was not dealing with a clergyman in his or her professional character. The defendant was not dealing with a clergyman as a spiritual advisor. He didn't seek counsel from this clergy person. He requested no spiritual advice, was offered none. And there was no confidentiality expressed between the two. So those were the four or five or so factors that that court found were dispositive and that should be applied when analyzing whether or not that privilege exists in any particular case. So I want to compare and contrast those four or five factors with what we have here. Unlike in Police, the lady here called herself specifically a chaplain. And Webster Dictionary defines that as a clergyman. The statute speaks in terms of a clergyman. She said she's employed by the hospital as an emotional, spiritual advisor to people who need it. And in this case, my client, Mr. Trammell, was in a very vulnerable position. He had just attempted suicide. His mental state was still up in the air. He still wanted to die. He was talking about God and how whether he didn't know if he believed in God or not, and he wanted spiritual counsel, and that's what she gave to him. And she specifically said, our conversation was, quote, spiritual in nature. And she believed that my client believed it was also, quote unquote, confidential.
Didn't she also testify that she was not a clergyman?
I don't recall that, and if she did, it certainly belies the record. It belies Webster's dictionary definition of what a clergy person is. It's a chaplain. A chaplain is defined under Webster's dictionary as a clergyman.
I don't know if we read the same Webster's, but the one I read said, a chaplain is a clergyman attached to a public institution, which I guess a hospital would be. But doesn't that still beg the question, what is a clergyman? And the definition of clergyman is, and Webster's is a bit more restrictive. It's an ordained minister or priest.
I would say in this particular case, when you present yourself to someone as the hospital chaplain, and when you say you counsel people who are in desperate need and dire, I think she even said emergency situations, and you counsel and pray with them, and you counsel them on spiritual matters, I think that amply satisfies the dictionary definition of a clergyman, and certainly for the privilege expressed here.
Counsel, how can it be confidential if the deputy is sitting in the room when this comment and when these communications are being made?
Well, that's something I noted in my brief, that he was far away, approximately 10 feet away, and they didn't know whether or not he was actually listening in on their conversation. And I think it even said somewhere in the record, I can't be exact about that, but she expressed she did not believe he was listening in, and he certainly wasn't participating in their conversation.
Well, whether he was listening in or participating, would you have an expectation that it was confidential when someone is 10 feet away? Now, maybe if you were whispering,
Well, I'm going to take Chaplain Lively at her word when she specifically said that the conversation was quote-unquote confidential. And she even
went, how'd they find out about that? How'd they find out about it, if it was a confidential
conversation? Well, she apparently had no qualms with revealing the confidential conversation. And I'm sure that they went to her, or she went to them, but she agreed with the district attorney when she said, well, what did Cramwell believe? What did the defendant believe? Was it a parishioner to a priest in competence? She agreed with that characterization. Now, what she did afterwards divulged his confidence. That's why we're here. I'm saying she acted improperly. The court also acted improperly by allowing her to divulge those confidences. But that doesn't mean that my client didn't think they were confidential. And according to her, he did.
Well, counsel, pardon me. We have some cases in the attorney-client privilege realm that indicate what the parties need to do in order to keep something confidential. And I don't see those things being done here. Under People versus Tucker and West versus Jefferson and DAS versus People, they talk about the circumstances must indicate the intention of secrecy and the communication must be private or secret. I'm having difficulty understanding why, if the parties aren't even sure if the deputy could hear them or not, they are so certain. They didn't say anything about secrecy. They mentioned confidentiality, but I didn't see anything in the testimony that talked about secrecy. Can you please speak to that?
Well, I would say that secrecy and confidentiality are one and the same. And I don't know how this is analogous necessarily to the confidentiality between attorneys and their clients. I'm sure there are some comparisons to be drawn. But what I'm really focused on is what limited stuff this court has said about this particular privilege that's a statutory privilege. And
well, why shouldn't we apply the same reasoning, since it's the same language in the statute as it is in the attorney-client privilege statute? Why shouldn't we apply the same reasoning requiring that the parties attempt secrecy?
Well, I don't really know how you would attempt secrecy, and I don't know that it's on my client he's bedridden. They stationed an officer in his bedroom. I mean, what is he going to tell the officer? Get out of here?
Or they can whisper, or, you know.
They might have been. I'm not sure.
But there's nothing in the record to indicate that they did. That's the problem.
Well, but what is in the record is this chaplain's testimony that this conversation was in confidence. I take her at her word on that, in that respect, and there was nothing that conflicted with that. The DA didn't put on any testimony to show that this wasn't in confidence, or that he was blabbing his mouth all around the hospital, or that the officer was somehow engaged in
but the burden is on the person seeking to invoke the privilege.
Well,
so
I think we fully established it by eliciting from the person who wants to divulge it that, well, I want to divulge it, but I got to be honest with you, it was in confidence. It was a confidential, spiritual conversation in nature. I think we fully met the burden on that. And without any direct testimony to the contrary by the prosecution, I don't see how we haven't satisfied our burden on that. So my point is this, if you compare the factors laid out in Police to what happened here, it's an entirely different scenario. And the four or five factors that this court articulated were important to look at when evaluating whether this privilege exists, all go in our favor in this case.
Could it have been harmless error?
I'll move to that now.
Okay.
I agree with the Attorney General that what my client said to Chaplain Lively could have been interpreted a number of ways. It could have been interpreted to inure to our benefit, but like the DA argued repeatedly below, it was not to our benefit. In fact, that's one of the primary pieces of evidence that they use to say that my client intended the harm that he ended up causing. His testimony when he sat up there and relinquished his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent was, look, yes, I wanted them to kill me. I was a desperate man. I didn't intend to hurt anybody. They tackled me. I had the bar in my hand, and it struck them. I did not intentionally strike them. That's the heart of the case, is whether he intended the harm or not. And yes, you could say that what he said to Lively says he planned it, meaning he planned the altercation so he could be shot, but that's not how the DA used it in closing, especially. They used it as their primary piece of evidence to show his intent. And I'll even quote what they said. We know he had a plan. We know his intent was to hurt someone because that's what he told the chaplain. And he admitted to Lively, yes, I planned this. Action, words, and opportunity. We know he had the intent to harm people. We have the chaplain from a hospital telling you, yes, the defendant told me that he planned this. You have to evaluate, and this is critical, Lively's testimony against that and Mr. Trammell. They're saying two different things. He's saying, I never told her that, and a chaplain from the hospital is telling you, yeah, he told me he planned this. Ladies and gentlemen, that's proof of intent. When someone specifically says, I planned this. So not only were my client's statement used to directly show his mental state, but also to impugn his credibility after he testified. She's saying, look, on the one hand, we have this chaplain. Now, who's ever going to impugn the credibility of the chaplain versus my client, the assaulter? Now, who are you going to trust here? She says this, he says she didn't say this, or he didn't say this. So not only was it used by the DA extensively to show my client's intent to harm these victims, but it was also used to impugn his credibility and contrast it against that of a chaplain. And I think that that is clearly harmful under these circumstances, especially when what we're talking about is someone's mental state. We're not talking about something that can be proved with any other sort of external evidence. We don't have any sort of cumulative evidence. What we have is what he said versus his actions and what the prosecutor argued he said to the chaplain, showing his intent. If there are no other questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Very good. You have about 3 minutes and 16 seconds.
Good afternoon. May I please report Will Kozlowski, registration number 37824, on behalf of the people. This court has observed defendant had the burden of establishing the applicability of clergy member privilege to the communications he's discussed. In order to do so, he had to present evidence, and the trial court had to find four things under the statute: that he had communications with a clergy member, that those communications were confidential, that the communication was made to a clergy member in her professional capacity, and that the communication was made in the course of discipline expected by the religious body to which this clergy member belonged.
Counsel, can I home you in on the confidentiality piece? What evidence was there in the record, either way, regarding whether this was a confidential or not a confidential communication?
Well, I think there's two points in time with reference to that. In the offer of proof, defendant did not make any representation that it was a confidential discussion. He merely said that it was spiritual in nature. When
this is pre-trial?
It was before she testified. It was during trial.
During trial.
And when the prosecutor called her, and actually, I should go back. That was the explicit ruling of the trial court, was that he had made no representations in his offer of proof that this was a confidential communication, and so he allowed the chaplain to testify. When she got up and testified, the prosecutor elicited that in her duties as the chaplain, she keeps the discussions confidential, and I believe the prosecutor asked a question with, was this discussion similar to how a priest would keep something confidential with a parishioner? And I believe she said yes. And that was the only evidence either way.
Was there a request to revisit that ruling after the witness had so testified?
I believe right after she testified to that, and once they got into the specific discussions, defendant objected again. He just said in the trial court noted the previous objection for the record.
You said that was the only evidence on confidence that was presented. I take it from the offer of proof or something. There wasn't it.
There wasn't any in the offer of proof. No, it was just he represented that it was a spiritual conversation. As to the first requirement.
Did the deputy hear what was said?
He testified he did not hear. But I think, Your Honor, it does show that he's there, and there was no evidence that they she didn't say, oh, we made sure he couldn't hear or anything like that. He testified he didn't hear, but I think it is evidence that they didn't believe their conversation was necessarily meant to be completely confidential. As to whether the chaplain was a clergy member, once again, in the offer of proof, the defendant said she was the chaplain, and the prosecutor said she's not a priest, rabbi, minister, or clergy member, and defendant didn't dispute that. He said, defense counsel said that he thought it was the function of the person who's listening to the statement, and whether or not she had a formal position in any church is not an issue. I believe that position's directly contrary to the language of the statute, which specifically calls for someone to be a clergy member, and that the communication be made in the course of discipline expected by the religious body to which the clergy member belongs.
What is a clergy member?
Well, it's defined in a few other places, and I've cited them in the brief. They're mostly mandatory reporting acts, and those sections define a clergy member as a priest, rabbi, a duly ordained commissioned or licensed minister of the church, a member of a religious order, or a recognized leader of a religious body.
A member of a religious order? Would she not qualify as a member of a religious order?
I don't think we have any evidence to that effect. All she said is that she was a chaplain at the hospital, and that was clearly a title bestowed at the hospital. There was no discussion of whether she was a clergy member in her religion. She said she attended Greeley Wesleyan Church, and the prosecutor represented that she was a Protestant. And there was no evidence that she was a clergy member of her church.
I thought you said clergy member defined it as a member of a religious institution.
A member of a religious order.
Okay, so she says, I'm a member of a Wesleyan Protestant church. Is that not a member of a religious order?
Well, if that's the definition of clergyman, then any person who is a member of a religion would be a clergyman.
Tell me why that's not the definition.
Why every person is not a clergy member?
Did you just read to me a definition of clergy member that said a member of a religious order?
Yes.
What's lacking from a person who says, I'm a member of the Wesleyan Protestant Church? What's lacking?
Well, I think if you look at the Waters case that I cited in the brief out of Arizona, that the definition religious order, clergy member, those should be defined by the specific religion should define what those things are. That courts and legislatures are obviously not in the business of defining who is and isn't a member of a religious order as to a specific religion. That is your question?
Yep.
And I think I've touched on the first two requirements of the statute, and as to the last, that it was made in the course of discipline expected by the religious body to which the clergy member belongs. And as counsel has discussed, there's not much law in this in Colorado, but the Archibeque case out of, once again, Arizona, said that prong test focuses on the duties and obligations of the clergyman and the rules and customs of the cleric's faith. And we simply have no evidence here of the rules and customs of Ms. Lavely's religion. So, once again, I believe the defendant failed to establish the burden on that prong as well. Is the court any other questions?
Do you feel that we, or not do you feel? Do you have any indication of whether we should be looking at other types of confidentiality, such as attorney-client privilege, in determining what the meaning is of this statute, the clergy statute?
I think it would be other cases dealing with other privileges would certainly be relevant in construing them. The Supreme Court has said that the entire statute should be strictly construed because it withholds relevant information. And I think with that in mind, I haven't looked at the entire statute. I'm pretty sure most, if not all, of the things in the statute are, for lack of a better word, legal statuses. You are an attorney under the law, you are a certified counselor, you are a licensed medical marriage counselor. So I think any cases construing if a person meets that, or if the communications within that relationship were met, could possibly be relevant, absolutely.
What Supreme Court opinion were you just referring to when you said that the whole statute should be strictly construed?
The Hartman case is a Supreme Court case, and the Garrison case is a Court of Appeals case that say the privileges should be strictly construed. If there are no other questions, I ask you to affirm the judgment of conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
If it looks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's a duck. Okay? She's a chaplain. She's a member of the Wesleyan Protestant Church. She counsels people in spiritual matters. She counsels people in confidence. What more do we need? What more would fit the definition of the statute?
Do we need something from somebody, some text, some document from the Wesleyan Protestant Church that says when you're talking to people on spiritual matters, we keep them confidential? Do you need something like that?
I don't think we need anything to that extent. I think the fact that there's no contravailing information and that you said, I speak to people on spiritual matters who are in need, who are in emergency situations, who need my spiritual counsel, and it's in confidence, that's plenty.
And does she say, I do that because the dictates of my faith require me to do that? Or did she say, nah, I do this because I think this is what a chaplain should do?
I don't know if she said that one way or another. My point is that when you evaluate what she was doing in its total, you evaluate what she said, what the testimony was, she was clearly acting as a clergyman in this capacity. That doesn't mean everybody that goes to the Wesleyan Church is a clergyman, but if you call yourself a chaplain, which is defined as a clergyman in Webster's Dictionary, and you function as a chaplain, and you function as a clergyman, you're a clergyman. Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
Just briefly on the sentencing.
Excuse me, counsel. I don't believe you raised that in your opening argument, did you? And I don't think we asked any questions of opposing counsel about that.
Oh, well, that's a good point. Okay.
Unless, I'm sorry to do the.
I do have a question for you about the sentencing, because I looked at the PSIR and it seems to indicate the correct sentencing range. So it's hard for me to understand how the trial court would have been misled if the PSIR was given the correct sentencing range. How are you saying we should presume that because the prosecutor was arguing for a higher sentence that the trial court was misled?
No, I think we should presume because the prosecutor said that the sentence was something that it wasn't, and nobody said the defense, we should have, we didn't. We should have said, no, that's not the right ranges.
Well, but can't we assume that the trial court looked at the PSIR and saw what the correct ranges were?
Well, then I would assume that the trial court would have corrected the prosecutor when he misstated what the ranges were, but he didn't. Nobody did, and in fact, he gave exactly what the prosecutor said the minimum range was, which was inaccurate.
But he didn't say he was giving it as a minimum. What I'm having trouble with is the concept that we're supposed to presume that the trial court got it wrong, even though the trial court didn't say anything on its own that indicated that it was misled.
I think in a case like this, where the evidence is strong that everybody misapprehended the proper sentencing guidelines, it's no skin off anyone's nose just to send it back down and say, Judge, if you misapprehended, then redo it. If you didn't misapprehend it, then affirm it. That's all you had to do. We don't even require a hearing for that.
Thank you, counsel.
And that's all I'm asking for. Thank you.
Thank you both for your fine arguments. The case is submitted and a decision will be forthcoming in due course.